And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2409. And call Steve Matten and Jim Nass, I think are the people signed up, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Matten. I represent the city of Portland, and today I'm also representing the local government employers who prevailed in the litigation before Judge Lipsman. We are speaking today and urging your support for the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2409. We feel that it's necessary to expedite this litigation to the Supreme Court, and this amendment will do that. Thank you very much. I'll accept any questions.
Any questions? Thank you. Jim?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Nass, legal counsel for the appellate courts. We support the Dash 2 amendments. We had concerns with House Bill 2409 in terms of the way it was originally written with the certification process, but the Dash 2 amendments resolved the concerns that the Court of Appeals had, and we are satisfied with the Dash 2s.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks. We'll also enter into the record a letter from Bill Gary regarding 2409. Anyone else wishing to testify in 2409? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2409 and open a work session on House Bill 2409. Representative Brown?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2409.
Representative Brown moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2409. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Well, Representative McPherson.
The Dash 2s, of course, date back to February, and I know there's been some further discussion about whether how this expedite provision interacts with the expedite provisions in the other bills we've passed. Have those been resolved at this point?
Representative McPherson, I believe that there is going to be some resolution on one of those issues in a House bill that's currently in the Senate.
Ah, I see. So this is the vehicle.
Yeah, and if that for some reason doesn't take place, I think we'd need to maybe put that in the Senate bill in the House, send it back to the Senate. So, yeah, we weren't planning to do it in this bill. Okay. Other questions, other discussion, any objections to the Dash 2s? Seeing no objections, the Dash 2s are adopted. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House Bill 2409 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Brown has moved House Bill 2409 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? No discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Excuse
the
phone.
Representative Ford.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative
Nolan.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2409 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we probably shouldn't put it on the consent calendar, so I'll go ahead and carry the bill. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2409. And if there's no objection to sending a couple of bills over to Rules for purposes of fixing anything that may need to be fixed after this committee is closed, I'll open work session on House Bill 2002.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I would move without recommendation as to passage House Bill 2202 be referred to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs.
House Bill 2002. Representative Brown has moved House Bill 2002 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Rules. Is there a discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative
Jose Brown.
Aye.
Jose Butler.
Excused.
Representative Capoli.
No.
Jose McPherson.
Aye.
Jose Nolan.
Aye.
Jose Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
And Chair Knope.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2002 will be sent to rules. Close the work session on House Bill 2002. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3169.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I would move House Bill 3169 without recommendation as to passage be referred to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, then Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Brown has moved House Bill 3169 without recommendation as to passage to be referred to Committee on Rules and Public Affairs and then Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? No discussion? Same as the last one, colleagues. We just want to make sure we have vehicles and rules should purse close, which I think would happen in the not too distant future, and if we should need to make changes or consider other amendments or conflicts that may arise, we'd have vehicles and a committee that will be open in order to do that. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Excused.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received required number of votes, House Bill 3169 is moved to rules. Close the work session on that bill, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 325A. I believe we have some amendments, Representative Richardson. A-A9 amendments. Did you want to talk about those?
Yes. Would you like me to hear it?
I would like you to be wherever you would feel most comfortable.
Okay. I will go down because I think there are some questions. Chair Knope, members, the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 325 are designed to do two things. In the near future, they are to expand the ability of public sector workers to continue to work after they are retired. That is done by expanding the limitations in the present law that say that certain classes of PERS employees who retire can continue to work if they're from counties of under 35,000 population, and expanding that number to 76,000, so it basically raises it to about two-thirds of the counties in the state of Oregon. And then it goes beyond that, and it deals with a policy matter. It says that this expansion of the ability to work and collect two paychecks will continue until July 1 of next year. And then from that point, there is an amendment which is kind of a policy explanation for Oregon, and basically it deals with Oregon's public sector jobs policy, and it states that essentially from July 1st of next year on, it will be the general rule in Oregon that an employee in public sector should continue to work until they're ready and willing to retire, and then at the point of retirement they should go ahead and retire and step aside and allow that job to be filled by a younger generation employee. There are someone to move up into the position and someone to move into that position and so forth, but create jobs for those that are looking to come into a job in Oregon. Right now, Oregon's number one export is our youth. They graduate from college, they can't get meaningful work, and they have to move to other places, and we want to do all that we can to combine our efforts with that stated by the governor in creating jobs for Oregonians, and the public sector is certainly an important place where there's a tremendous number of jobs available. And as I say, this does not come into play until July 1st of next year, and that allows our public sector employers to get through this difficult time that's a time of upheaval caused by the PERS reforms and the economy. So basically it says that as of July 1st of next year, a PERS retiree will not work for a PERS employer for 24 months following the date of retirement. And after that time, they could come back, and the 1040 rule would apply. And because there's a tremendous and unique need in the very small counties of our state, those counties with under 35,000 total population are exempted or waived from these requirements. So for the very small counties, they have the ability to hire employees that have retired under PERS, but for all the other counties after July 1st of next year, it is assumed that when you retire, you should step aside and let those jobs be available for the other workers.
Questions? Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, I should know the geography here, but if you could help me, you said that the counties under 75,000 would cover about two-thirds of the counties. Could you give me a guess on what proportion of the population of the state would be covered?
Okay, if I said 75, I meant to say 76,000.
Okay.
Would you like to have the numbers or the names of those counties, or what would you like?
What I'm trying to get a figure feel for is,
okay,
you referenced that it was two-thirds of the county. What I want to know is, what percentage of the population of the state would be able to benefit from this?
I do not know the populations of those counties, excepting that I could do the math and add it all up. We're starting from Wheeler, which has a population of 1,547, and it goes up through there to Josephine, which had 75,726 as of the last census.
About 35% of Oregonians.
A third.
Yeah.
Okay.
A little less.
He's very quick with this. Maybe I should address my questions to
that's
you.
Quick that's quick math. So.
Could I follow up, please?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, you and I have had a discussion about this proposal before. And what I'm having a hard time understanding is that if it is good policy for the legislature to allow a local governing board in a small county to make the decision to do this, why would it not be good policy for the state to allow any locally elected governing board to make this decision on their own?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I believe that the answer to that lies in focusing on the intent, which is to deal with jobs. And the more rural and the less the population of a county, the more difficulty they have in hiring qualified people for public sector jobs. In the past, it's been basically a level placed at 35,000. There's been a number of communities and school districts in counties that are larger than that that have come forward and said, we are having a tremendous problem getting through this upheaval at this time. Could that be lifted? And so the bar has been proposed to be lifted to 76,000. Certainly counties above that could benefit, but they have a larger pool of job applicants, better demographics to fill their needs. And so to go any larger, the larger we go, the less jobs will be available to those that are not retiring. So it's kind of a policy decision, and the line had to be drawn somewhere, and so that's where the line is drawn.
One more follow-up, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, this may be a question that the PERS staff would be better able to answer. If this bill were enacted and fully utilized, have you had a chance to discuss with PERS whether it shifts some of the cost of the retirement system away from those local employers who take advantage of it and onto local employers who aren't able to take advantage of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I'm not sure if I'm answering the right question, but I'll take a shot at that. One of the problems that we have in the current system is that PERS is based on receiving contributions from each of the PERS members. And when a person retires from PERS and then goes back to work for the public sector, then the employer does not make any PERS contributions for that slot. And so the more widely that is done, the less money goes into the PERS system as part of the overall health that is just part of the PERS plan. And so I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that the more that we implement a policy where people retire and move out of the system and new people are hired, for every one of those positions where there is a new person hired, there will be PERS contributions made to the PERS fund.
I take that answer to be yes, that it shifts costs from employers who would be able to use this onto employers who can't. That's the way I understood the answer.
Mr. Chair, there was a Nolan. That is correct. But I would like to expand, though, that by limiting this to counties, eventually it'll be limited to counties under 35,000. These are counties that, under the present law, have already excluded teachers and educators, and which are the primary number of public sector workers in these rural counties. And so they are already excluded. And so basically it just expands it to those additional public sector workers who are not involved in education.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Barker and then Representative Butler.
Representative, on the there's people working in public employees who are not in PERS, like myself. I was an equal to or better than, so that I could go ahead and work in a PERS job after I retired. And the guy who next to me, who we annexed in from Multnomah County Sheriffs, who stayed in PERS, would not be able to do that if we both retired the same day. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, it is correct that this only applies to those that are within the PERS system. And it's focused primarily on the tremendous concern by many, many citizens on situations where there's people that are retiring on Friday and continuing to work on Monday, the following Monday, in the same job, the same hours, the same duties, but they collect full retirement checks plus their full salary checks. And that job is not going to be available to those that would have normally moved into it, and there's no PERS payments being made by the employer into the PERS system.
Yes. And the people who become involved in this, who stay on the job, as of July 1st, 2004, are they then gone? Does that terminate that kind? If I retire now and I'm in PERS and I want to work, And the school, for example, says, yeah, you can stay out here as long as you want, but next July, I can't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, it is correct that as of next July 1st, if you retire within 24 months, then you would not be able to continue working. And so it gives public sector employers 14 months to revisit their employment and recruiting strategies so that they take out recent retirees from their pool of recruits.
Okay, and the one other thing, if I may, one other thing I was wondering about, there's a lot of elected offices, judges and things, I don't know, and all these different boards and so on. So if somebody's a retiree from PERS, they would not be able to, they just have to opt out. They wouldn't be allowed to get into PERS if they went into a new job.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, if they're judges or legislators, then they are not in the PERS system. If they're on a board, normally they would be at per diem, which is not part of this. If they're on a salary in the PERS system and they've recently retired from a PERS job, then it would apply to them.
But I mean, I'd say like city council, or I mean, there's a lot of those jobs aren't PERS jobs, or some, I don't know how many, but paid public employment jobs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I'm not aware of city councilmen that are on PERS, but in Southern Oregon we don't have that. But if that's the case, if you know, it applies to PERS represented PERS employees who want to continue working for a PERS employer after they retire for 24 months.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one clarification and one question. Clarification relative to the question that Representative Nolan was asking. Under the current system, I believe that when we have presently, when a school administrator comes to one of the small schools, one of these small counties, what happens is that there's both a covered and an uncovered PERS rate, and that what happens is that when we have a school administrator that comes to one of the small schools in one of the small counties, that there's actually a greater rate applied to the covered compensation, and consequently it doesn't shift it to other employers in the county or in the system anywhere. It actually absorbs it within because there's a higher rate, but it isn't dollar for dollar for that particular school because they have fewer folks that are going to be drawing on that account.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to make that clarification, and I don't understand. It's my understanding that your bill doesn't change that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I also believe that it doesn't change that.
Okay. And then my question is that relative to, again, back to these small counties where we do have some of those school districts that are, in effect, using these temporary administrators moving in from other locations that want to finish up until they're 60 or 65, and are working in these and bringing very valuable knowledge, very valuable skills to those schools in counties of under 35,000 or less, that won't interrupt those after 24 months, will it?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
And just a clarification, this bill would probably apply to about 750,000 Oregonians, or roughly 21% of the population. So a little bit under the 30% that my quick math was, but I sat here and added them up as we were had the discussion, and that's about what it comes out to.
But Mr. Chair, again by way of clarification, it affects those folks, that 21% that live in those small counties or counties under 75,000 people, under 76,000 people. But they will end up paying the rate that they that subsidizes back for all covered employees under the present rules and present programs. So I just want to make sure that that's the case.
I would never argue with the CPA.
Well, that's my understanding from the PERS folks from earlier discussion.
Really?
Mr. Chair?
I don't want to talk to Ozzie Rose. Steve Delaney, could you answer that?
For the record, Steve Delaney, Oregon PERS. My apologies. A lot of people are asking a lot of questions back here, so I didn't get to hear them.
Steve, the comment was, and we've gone over this before, when you have in a small rural school situation, and let's use Harper School because that's where the genesis of part of this was. When I have an administrator that's retired in another system to come into that school where you can stay overnight because it's a dormer school and take care of the school for the three nights a week that they're having school, then when the payroll is calculated, his payroll is uncovered payroll, his or her payroll is uncovered, then the balance of the payroll is the covered, but a higher rate has applied to that. Consequently, it doesn't offset dollar for dollar, but my understanding that by and large the system is still made whole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's actually not the case for school districts because they're pooled.
Oh, they're pooled.
If you're referring to a local government employer unpooled, that would be the scenario.
Right.
But for a pooling, the pool will cover the cost. I'll give you an example. We did get contacted by a small Eastern Oregon school district where they had only two teachers, and both are prepared to retire. And they said, are we understanding this correctly, that if both our teachers retire and return as reemployed retirees, that we would pay no further PERS contributions, and that would be correct. Yet the school pool retains the UAL, unfunded actuarial liability.
And they pay in on that?
They wouldn't, because they wouldn't have any covered salary. So it's the pool that would cover that. Now, whether it's pertinent, whether it will actually cause a shifting of costs, is the question. PERS has posed that question to Milliman USA, asking what number of retirements would have to occur, what number of re-employed retirees would have to return for it actually to cause an actual shifting that would appear in rates. We don't have that information yet, but we're assuming it's several thousand re-employed retirees would have to be involved in this for there to be some kind of cost shifting within a pool.
Follow up on that, Mr. Chair. Do we know how many have taken advantage of it? It's my understanding that there aren't that many. There probably aren't 100 at this point, but do you know how many have taken advantage of the small schools program that we do have now?
I am unaware, and the reason for that, Representative Knope, Representative Butler, would be the fact that the employer doesn't contact PERS. As long as the employer falls within that 1039 exemption or an open exemption, there'd be no reason to tell PERS because they're outside of the PERS plan at that point.
I've only, Mr. Chair, I've just heard of just Baker School 5J. I know it's taken advantage. Certainly Harper, who it was set up for. I've talked to a couple of other of those small schools in the small counties that I represent in rural eastern Oregon, and they do shift teachers around, teachers and administrators around under this. But I'd be surprised if it was widespread at this point because it is fairly new. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Butler, Representative Butler, let me add to this that ORS Section 238.082 already provides for that, and this amendment will not change that law. So there's no change in the way that that calculation be made.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Nolan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to clarify something that you said, Mr. Delaney, with respect to a local employer whose 100% of whose employees retire. You said that they would have no obligation to contribute to PERS. I had, in previous discussions on other issues, understood from you that any employer who has participated in PERS and the creation of the unfunded liability, even when they are no longer in PERS or no longer have employees in PERS, are still on the hook to help retire the unfunded liability. Is it different in the circumstance that you described here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, that is a good point. It is different in the sense that the employer is still active in this case. They simply don't have covered salary. And the anticipation is that at some point they will have covered salary to again begin paying into their liability. Now, you have addressed an issue that PERS itself is studying at this point. What of those very small entities that are pooled and therefore could shift a cost due to having no covered salary for a given period of time, what is the method in which we would charge them for liability that was incurred? Statute addresses salary as one methodology for determining what payments an employer pays in to cover their liability, but that is not necessarily the sole means by which we could determine a liability of an employer, and we are working on that at the moment. We'll probably be addressing that by administrative rule.
Still processing.
When will the stuff be ready for the stuff? And I use that as a technical term. Be done by Millman, USA.
Mr. Chair, I'm unsure. I would assume we could, if the committee is requiring it, we could get it from them within several weeks because it was something that we asked of them some months ago, and the issue simply had not been as pressing recently, so therefore we had not followed up with them on it. We can check to see where they are with it.
Mm. Other questions, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Delaney, I want to make sure that I have the cost aspects of reemployment of retirees kind of properly sorted out in my own mind. I think the case is that once someone is retired and there's a decision about whether they will come back into public employment, there's not an additional cost to having them come back into the system. And in fact, if they're coming back in and not accruing a further benefit, there's even some savings to the system in so doing. The cost issue in this change is when you look at, assume you have someone who is in public employment who is eligible to retire, say eligible for an unreduced benefit, and they're making a decision whether to retire or not. And in my experience as a practitioner in the field, it is not an unusual situation for someone who is in that position, that is, they're eligible for an unreduced benefit and who would like to continue working, to see an opportunity that if they can retire and then be reemployed into the system, into the perhaps even the same position they were in before, that's desirable from their individual standpoint, but that as compared to a situation where they remain working in their position before without becoming then eligible for retirement, that there is there's an additional cost system-wide when you have someone who is able to then retire and get both as compared to remaining receiving just their current paycheck because they're not drawing then the retirement check that they could get unreduced. Is that a sort of fair analysis of the economics?
It is, Representative Knope, Representative Pearson. With this caveat, what Representative Butler was referring to as far as a cost shift, when you have a local government employer that is not pooled, they have a set liability that they have to pay based on, and we again use the covered salary as our means by which we get the contributions to pay off that liability. If one of your employees retires, you're correct. The additional growing liabilities has stopped because that employee has retired, and we will have assigned the cost of that retirement to that employer. But the covered salary has now shrunk. The liability amount that they have to pay hasn't changed, but the covered salary has shrunk, and so therefore their incremental contribution rate may actually go up slightly. That isn't really a rise in cost. The total owed to the fund hasn't changed, but the basis upon which they're going to pay that obligation has shrunk because they have one less person with the covered salary, and so therefore, unpooled employers, there can be an adjustment upward of the contribution rate. In a pool, that would not be the case. Covered salary would be slightly shrunk, but the pool as a whole is covering this liability. Did I question marks? I may not have
follow up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was really focusing on sort of let's not concern ourselves for the moment with how it impacts on one individual employer as opposed to the system, but just look system wide. That as compared to a situation where employee A, who's active and who has an unreduced benefit available to them, remains in active employment and does not draw a pension and continues working and drawing their paycheck, and compare that with a situation where that same employee is able to retire, come back into the same position, and then draw both the pension and their current pay at, say, the same pay level. It on the surface of it appears to me there's an additional cost to the system, to the PERS system, in their being able to draw that benefit sooner.
Mr. McPherson, you'd be correct. If the person has not worked the anticipated career, and Milliman USA is looking to a 30-year career period, so if that person were to retire at 29 years, and therefore we were shy a year of what was anticipated by the actuary.
No, I was positing a situation where they've already worked for 30 years. They have an unreduced benefit available to them. So the same dollars they could draw by retiring today are the dollars they will receive if they retire 2, 3, 4, 5 years later.
Mr. Epson McPherson, my understanding from, and I caveat that not having Mark Johnson here to speak to this, my understanding is that if the person has worked to the point of an unreduced benefit, a 30-year career employee, then the dollars that were anticipated to be the period of time that was required to reach a benefit that was fully funded would have passed, and whether that person worked additional years or retired at that point would not incur that. Retiring at the point at which the actuary assumed they would retire would not incur an additional cost.
Mr. Chair. I think I'll drop that point at the moment, although I think the simple economics are dollars today are more valuable than dollars several years from now. It's the time value of money. So to the extent that that individual who's eligible for an unreduced benefit can draw it today by retiring and come back and then draw the pension and their same paycheck, there's more being paid to that person in value than if they wait 5 years and then start drawing the same pension at that point. So there is an extra cost, and it is a cost, I believe, to someone. And then following up on Representative Nolan's point or line of questioning as to how that falls out as upon the various employers, if you look at, for example, the pooling of school employees across the state, if they're pooled together in their rates, so they're all collectively bearing the average cost of delivering benefits to across all school teachers in Oregon, if we allow one subgroup, that is their smaller rural districts, to avail themselves of this technique of having people retire and then get hired back and draw their pension sooner, that's an additional cost to the average rate that's spread across all those school districts, and yet only the smaller rural districts can avail themselves of it. So I think on the surface of it, I'd have to say there is a situation here where the expansion of the availability of benefits to people who come back to work in public service is, it's adding cost to the system, and that cost is benefiting because it's only available to a subset of all school districts, for example, and other kinds of employers under this bill. It's benefiting those jurisdictions to the detriment of those that are not eligible for it. It's not really a question.
If I defer to the former, to the latter, I would concur.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, except that this law doesn't change those teachers. They already have the ability to do that in the small counties, and so all this does is expand it to the very small percentage of other public service employees in small counties, because education is already exempted under the 35,000 population.
Right. Mr. Chair, if I could, Representative Richardson, I understand the proposal is actually, it kind of goes both directions. It's on a bill that expands the opportunity to allow the return to public service without a reduction in the benefit, but with a window in time after which then it becomes more restrictive than it has been in the past. So this the proposal here in front of us goes both directions. It's more liberal for a time and then more restrictive thereafter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. I think I'm going to close the work session on this today. I don't think we're going to move it today. Close the work session on House Bill 325A. And I don't believe we're going to move the other bill on our agenda either. So I believe we have completed our work for today. And we will likely meet again next week. And as soon as we have the agenda ready, we will let you know.
I might have one last comment before we close. I just want to make sure that our committee administrator understands that my no votes on the bills that were being sent to the Rules Committee in no way reflect my admiration for the committee administrator of the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
And I'm sure she believes that.
No, I do.
And with that, committee's adjourned.